The amount of information any patient can access in their phones at any time of day just vastly dwarfs whatever they could have accessed before. And just with any good tool, that comes with incredible promise and also incredible risks.
Chatbots that respond to patients asking questions through their electronic medical record, face-to-face conversations with healthcare professionals during an office visit, digital libraries you can access at your convenience. There are more ways than ever before to get information about how to maintain your health, improve it, better understand the medical journey of a friend or loved one, or investigate a challenge or concern that's emerging in your own life. So why is health literacy such a struggle? Just 12% of Americans are proficient at finding, understanding, and using information and services to make informed health-related decisions, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That doesn't mean people aren't trying. 40 million Americans use AI tools like ChatGPT every day for healthcare-related questions, and hundreds of millions, up to 80% of U.S. adults, according to one survey, get health information online at least once a year. Where's the big disconnect? And how are healthcare practitioners and organizations working to combat misinformation, build trust and credibility with patients, and anticipate new challenges as an increasingly diverse information ecosystem continues to change at breakneck speed? Welcome to Living Healthy Together. This week we're diving into health literacy, misinformation, and the importance of being prepared and knowing what to talk about and what to ask during your medical appointments. We're joined now by Chrissy Keating, the health literacy specialist at University of Vermont Medical Center. Chrissy, thanks so much for joining us today and for talking about this important topic. Let's frame the issue for folks, because I don't think this is something that most folks give a lot of internal bandwidth to. What is health literacy, and where does it sit in everyone's personal responsibility?
Thank you so much for having me to talk about health literacy, because it's a passion of mine. Let me start with the definition of health literacy, and that is the ability to find, understand, and use health information. And it used to be on the patient to be able to understand everything that their clinician was telling them. But now we've expanded that definition to not just include the patient, but also include the responsibility of the healthcare system to communicate in a way that works for the patient.
Communication is really important. We spend a lot of time on this show telling people, go talk to your primary care provider. Make sure you're honest with them. Talk a little bit about what it means to be a health literacy specialist. Do you work directly with patients?
My role was created about 5 years ago, and it lives in the culture, experience, and community health department. And I work both internally with employees and with community partners. So I really have the best of both worlds. And because of my years of experience in working in community health, I know how important clear communication is, especially when building trust. And when you think about health literacy, nearly 9 out of 10 adults struggle with health information at some points in their life. And that affects all of us. So anytime you go in to see your provider or you're in the hospital, it's really not the best time in your life. Usually you're a little stressed, you're a little emotional, and all those things can come into play when trying to understand what the provider is trying to explain to you, what your diagnosis is, and then how you move forward. So really, health literacy affects every step of care, from understanding a diagnosis to following your treatment, medication safety, and then prevention. This role, it's very unique to UVM Health, because typically this type of position lives under a chief nursing officer or a position in communications. But we were very specific about where we wanted this role to be, because we wanted it to fit in under health equity. It's a really great fit there, because our team works internally with employees and externally with community members. And our focus on health equity aligns with the framework of health literacy, and that's to ensure that communication is accessible and understandable for everyone.
I think one of the things it's really important for people to hear is that health literacy is not a one-way street. You are not an empty vessel that comes into a medical appointment ready to be filled up with knowledge by your practitioner, right? Healthcare providers need to understand how to talk to the public and to patients just as much as patients need to better understand how to talk with their healthcare providers. And I think that's what you're talking about. And obviously, culture and social determinants play a role in those conversations.
Absolutely. It's not just the responsibility of the patient to understand what health information is shared. It's also the responsibility of the healthcare system to communicate in a way that works for the patient. We really have to consider the voice of the community and meet them where they are. And that can be looking at print materials, what we're putting out on social media, what our web pages say, and what people find on the internet, and making sure that we're pointing people in the right direction, giving them the clearest information that we can in order for them to make the best health decisions for themselves.
The metaphorical airspace here is as crowded as it's ever been. People are walking around with supercomputers in their pockets, with access to much of the information and disinformation worldwide via the internet. What have you learned over the last 5 years about how this has changed? What are the big things that have changed and are impacting health literacy in our communities?
A great question. I'll start with what hasn't changed. Really, what hasn't changed is that nearly 9 out of 10 adults struggle with health information at some points in their lives. And that health literacy and accessible and understandable communication affects every step of care, from understanding a diagnosis to following their treatments to medication safety and preventive care. And poor health literacy leads to worse outcomes and higher costs and more inequity. What really has changed is the mindset around health communication. It used to be that your doctor knew everything. You did not question that person. They knew what was right for you, and they asked you to do what they told you to do. Now it's becoming more of a conversation, and we use the term patient-centered care, and that is more about shared decision-making instead of from the top down, because we are now starting to understand and realize that people can advocate for themselves. They have a lot going on in their lives, from their jobs to where they live. A lot of stressors are happening. And so we're really starting to incorporate those decisions and those parts of people's lives. And we're bringing those into the decision-making, because what works for one person doesn't work for another. So how we're doing that is really talking to people in a way that you would in your living room, trying to use plain language, using everyday words, focusing on what patients need to know and just not giving them every bit of information that you know. And then also really focusing on teach back, which is basically on the clinician to really make sure that the patient understands what they're saying and checking that they do understand. It's not a test, but it's more of a conversation. And then the last thing that I would say is changing is design and format. So just making sure that information is presented in various formats and that we are using and centering the patient voice as we design patient education materials.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Not everybody learns the same way, and everybody communicates differently too, right? I am almost painfully an open book. You ask me a question, and you just get way more than you bargained for, no matter what you're asking about.
Exactly. And in situations like that, we can also be nervous. So I can also overshare. I understand where you're coming from.
It's shocking and comforting that so many folks, 9 out of 10, struggle with health information. That's wild, but it's also comforting, right? You're not the only one. How do we know if we're moving the needle? And over what time span are these things looked at?
It's a collective experience. And even the most health literate person out there can have times that are really stressful. Think about being in the doctor's office or the emergency department, getting a new diagnosis. Like, these times are really not the best in our lives. We're sick, we're tired, anxious, scared. And that's just not a great time to take in and understand complex medical information, no matter who you are. And so how we can move that needle and know that we're making a difference is really, are we seeing improvements in healthcare and in people's health? Is that communication and trust really there? Do our patients feel like they're being seen? Do they feel like they're being heard? Do they see themselves represented in materials? And ultimately, do people feel respected? Patients are more likely to speak up when language feels safe and non-judgmental. And what also matters is consistency. We all know that during COVID, their information was ever-changing. And so that led to a lot of confusion and mistrust. And then lastly, we really want to have shared interest with our provider and feel like we're on the same team. Are we asking patients what's most important to them? Are we talking about that with them? Are we asking about their lives? Are we asking what's most important to them in this particular conversation? And then doing that shared decision-making, ultimately, our hope is that that leads to better health outcomes, and data is pointing in that direction.
We just did an episode highlighting some occupational therapy work across the region, and we sat down with patients and their OT in a conversation. And if you've listened to that episode, you will have heard the relationship that these folks have with each other. We had someone whose life was changed by a traumatic motorcycle accident, who was laughing and joking and having a great time talking about the challenges that he now faces and the progress that he's made with his occupational therapist. That's incredible. And that's not just about who he is, although Brian is definitely an indomitable person. That happens because he and his OT made a connection, were able to work through these ridiculous challenges together and feel good about it while they did it. I came away from that episode hoping that everyone can find that relationship with a healthcare provider that they work with. If you can find a physician or a practitioner that brings that out on you, you're really onto something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more that clinicians can be curious about a person, I think that sets up a better relationship too, making that patient feel very comfortable by normalizing questions, addressing any confusion, and also acknowledging emotions. A lot of this can be very emotional for people or in their families. So acknowledging that stress, that fear, information overload, I think that acknowledgement is a first step in a great relationship.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with a former patient and current volunteer and an expert in work that centers patient voices in healthcare and helps health systems like UVM Health design information, materials, and technology that puts patients at the center of their own care. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking about health literacy, being prepared for your doctor's visits, and building patient trust through communication, which is a really important thing that affects everyone in healthcare and outside of healthcare. We're joined now by Susanna Stinnett, a volunteer patient and family advisor at UVM Medical Center, and Vicky Mascareno-Nelson, patient engagement partner at UVM Medical Center and a former patient and family advisor. You both have an incredible amount of background knowledge and insight into health communication, health information, and education. So we're really excited to have you on the show today. Let's start, Susanna, with your journey to becoming a volunteer patient and family advisor. This springs from your own experiences in the hospital and in healthcare. Tell us what brought you here.
Yes, I would say that I was always a very healthy person until 3 years ago. And then post-COVID RSV infection, I became quite ill with a chronic complex syndrome of MCAS, histamine intolerance, POTS, basically all the long COVID symptoms that go along with that. And over the past 3 years, I had to meet with a number of different care providers ranging from physicians, naturopathic physicians, acupuncturists, and so on, vestibular physical therapist. So I had the opportunity to work with and be treated by a number of different healthcare providers. Through that process, I had a lot of ups and downs in terms of the progress of healing and also the experience of communication with care providers. And I would say that that is one piece that led me in an indirect way to the volunteer position. Additionally, one of the many things that I did in my treatment plan, my healing journey, was I joined the hospital's long COVID recovery support group, which was really key and instrumental in my becoming more connected with the hospital and also really finding my voice along with other members of that support group regarding healthcare and the treatment of long COVID patients and how critical communication is in the health recovery process.
Let's talk about your experience with communication on your medical journey. How did communication create high points and low points? Because my sense is that it probably created both, and that's why you wanted to volunteer and help address these challenges.
There were a number of emotions in the healing journey that I've been through, and that was created in part because of the wide variety of treatment plans and data that's out there for patients with long COVID. Sometimes those treatment plans were in conflict with each other, and so it created a lot of confusion, unsettling feeling of isolation, for sure. That's a real typical experience. And I also had a lot of beginning to identify as the illness rather than identifying as myself, so to speak. That's really important, too, for a care provider to have an awareness about how important it is to see their patient as a human being, as a person, rather than the illness itself. What I found is that most of the providers that I saw were very caring. A number of them were not super familiar with long COVID, although that has changed over the last year as more and more research has come out. Only one provider was truly dismissive and disinterested. And needless to say, I did not go back for a second visit there. And another provider who was very caring said to me, "Well, you look good." And that I burst into tears. It's the only time I ever burst into tears in a doctor's office. And it was meant as an affirmation. But what it did was it really triggered the, I'm making it look really good, but I do not feel really good. So what I found was really helpful from the care providers were those who listened and seemed to have a truly authentic, caring approach. Another thing that I think is really helpful is to offer tangible resources, literally handouts, links to places for more information. That was very, very beneficial for me. Also, something that I call a sacred pause during the medical visit, meaning just a 10-second pause where both the patient and the care provider are quietly thinking. There's a synergy that builds from that. And that creates trust and safety. Some care providers, they're so rushed, they have so little time, but just taking that time really creates something unique and helpful. Another physician had electronic note-taking software. When they asked my permission to use that, I said, sure. But I was really surprised at what it felt like as a patient. It felt so different to have the physician able to be totally present with me rather than simultaneously having to type on a laptop. Really made a big difference.
One of the first things you said, that affirmation gone wrong that caused you to have some big emotions. I want to call that out because I'm going to come to Vicky next to talk about this. When anybody hears health education or health literacy, they immediately think that that's a one-way street. This is something that a patient or a family member needs to know about how to be prepared for their visit or how to talk to their doctor. And that's not wrong, but there's a whole other side of this coin, and it's providers need education and support on how to talk to patients too. Vicky, talk about the patient and family advisor program, because this isn't a patient-facing program. This is a provider-facing group.
First off, let me just say a quick note about Susanna is that she is relatively new to the program. And when she reached out on the website, which was how she found us because she was looking to give back, and what she's sharing is exactly who our advisors are. So I just want to acknowledge her experience, and what she's talking about right now is what we look for. The overarching program is called the Patient Family Centered Care Program. And the definition of patient family centered care, according to the Institute for Patient Family Centered Care, is that it's an approach to the planning, the delivery, and the evaluation of healthcare that's grounded in mutually beneficial partnerships among healthcare, patients, families, and providers. And within that, between UVM Medical Center and Golisano Children's Hospital, we have just over 100 patient family advisors. And again, these are volunteers who share their care experiences and their wisdom and their lived experiences to improve our systems, which is around quality, safety, and the patient experience. I have such a privilege working with this group. And I have to tell you, what Susanna just shared and all the nuggets, one of the things that stuck out to me is you heard her talk about the sacred pause in communicating. And I think you're right. The one-way street sometimes when the patients are go into the office or to meet with the provider, it can feel very one way, especially when the appointment's so short. And I think the power of having patient family advisors as part of our organizational structure, because they sit on councils, projects, initiatives, is they say things like, hey, we need to pause. Hey, we need to hear each other. When the system keeps moving at the same pace in the same ways it always does, you know, patient family advisors are there to say, stop. Here's the patient perspective on this. Let me share my lived experience.
Vicky, how has the program grown and changed over time? What's the trajectory that we're on? Where are we now and where are we headed?
There's lots of change that we're considering and evolution of how to bring patient perspectives, you know, to every aspect of the organization. Is within the 3 years I was here, I just have to acknowledge I was an advisor for 5 years, but the team before me built a strong foundation. So I came in on a strong foundation. I also came in after COVID. So it was very tricky because our program changed just like everything else did. So there was a lot of reimagining, rebuilding that has gone on for 3 years. I came off a collaborative patient family advisory steering committee meeting this morning, and that's a group of employees and advisors coming together. Is we really are looking for quality partnerships with our patient family advisors. So the goal of our program is not to have 500 patient family advisors who we just kind of toss out and throw them into every aspect of the organization. The team, this large, really thoughtful think tank steering committee, is really looking at how to be mutually beneficial partners. And I'm going to use a word that I always use when I talk about patient family center care and advisors, which is co-design. The best thing we can do as an industry is to bring our patients and families to the table at the beginning when we're designing. We're not designing and saying, oops, now we want your stamp of approval, or oops, that didn't work, now help us. So we're really focused on co-design and transformation with our patient family advisors as collaborative partners.
The title of this episode is Building Patient Trust Through Communication. I heard from my parents when I was a kid, it takes forever to build trust and a second to break it. Is that true in healthcare? Is it all neatly wrapped up like it is with that soundbite? Or is it more complex than that when you get into healthcare and trust between a medical professional and someone who's sick or seeking care?
The messaging I hear from advisors usually is focused on trust, communication, and partnerships. So can trust be broken? I think the group would say, sure, it can be broken pretty quickly. They're not looking for doctors who have written the most research papers in their credentials. What I'm hearing is they lead with trust, partnership, collaboration, who's listening to what I'm really into, who's really hearing what I'm saying. The other thing I want to tell you, Phil, is in terms of what we can do about that in our program, is that we create partnerships to help fill these gaps. So for example, one aspect of communication is literally patient-facing education, right? What literally faces the patient. So Chrissy and I have partnered And she is launching a health literacy work group that has about 10 of our advisors, so that when we get requests for patient-facing materials, they go through a group of advisors who also are trained to look at health literacy. So we're trying to really expand what health literacy means within our own program so our advisors can become champions.
Susanna, what do you want to say that you think it's important for people to hear?
I think there's hope on the horizon. And I want to share a quote, if that's all right, which is, when a complex system is far from equilibrium, small islands of coherence in a sea of chaos have the capacity to shift the entire system to a higher order. And that is by a Belgian physical chemist and Nobel Prize recipient. And his name I will probably not pronounce correctly, but it's Ilya Prigogine. And I see that as the medical system in our country right now, and that this quote is relevant to that. It just takes providers who are willing and able to connect with their patients with trust and open communication.
Vicky, what do you hope folks take away from our episode today?
I'm going to keep it really short and simple because I want to elevate and amplify what Susanna just said. That was a beautiful quote. I'm just going to say, nothing about us without us. Patients and families want to be heard. They want to establish trust. They want to be your partners. And on the flip side, organizationally, there's a whole nother level where we need to include patient and family voice.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll sit down with an infectious disease physician and medical ethics expert and discuss finding trustworthy information in the digital age and the impact mistrust and misinformation is having on our relationship with healthcare. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking about a lot of different things today. We're talking about health literacy. We're talking about how to prepare for your medical appointments. We're talking about misinformation. We're joined now by Dr. Tim Leahy, an infectious disease specialist and director of the Medical Ethics Program at University of Vermont Lerner College of Medicine. Dr. Leahy, what's the best entry point into this conversation?
For me, it's a new day in health information. In that, if I compare today to 10 years ago, the amount of information any patient can access in their phones at any time of day just vastly dwarfs whatever they could have accessed before. With any good tool, that comes with incredible promise and also incredible risks. And I think whatever that promise and risk is in 2026 is going to be multiplied by the incredible emergence of AI in healthcare. And so I do think that while patients now have new access to ways of sort of saying, well, I'm having this symptom, should I be worried about it? Or when my doctor says that this medicine is not going to help me for this condition, they can just look up information and with a little caution, find good information. Also, our patients are inundated with fake news. You know, that there are grifters out there who are going to convince people that whatever symptom they have is the result of Lyme disease. There are people out there who are going to undermine their access to preventive health care like vaccines.
What do practitioners say to each other? We've talked a lot and we're going to continue to talk a lot about how patients and providers talk to each other. How do these conversations go among healthcare professionals?
I think when you have that conversation with an MD and a PA or an NP and a RNR in the hallway, their personality types are going to affect what they say. We have the early adopters who sort of say, the internet is changing everything. It's so much better to be a patient now. Or thank God for ChatGPT. Now you hardly even need a doctor because it'll just diagnose you. They're definitely the early adopters and God love them. I'm glad they help get new great technologies to the field. But also they're probably a little bit zealous and a little less willing to speak to the risks. There are also the detractors. There are the people who say, medicine is over. Patients can't tell the difference between Dr. Google and me. And they're kind of behind the times, I think, and threatened by this whole thing. Not to say there's no threat, but I don't think the entry into needed change and innovation is to be fearful. I think the big middle is speaking about how it's incredible that you can drop a story into your favorite AI model and get a reasonably good response to it. Or it's fantastic that there are so many trustworthy websites out there where you can get good information from the American Heart Association or from the CDC or whatever that'll just teach you stuff that you couldn't have known 10 years ago. I think most people are focusing on the goods. They know there are risks out there, that misinformation is epidemic nowadays, and we saw it undermine our responses to the pandemic, and we are seeing it hurt lots of avenues in health right now. But I think we still have trust that just like you can learn to use a scalpel, you can learn to prescribe chemotherapy, we can learn to use health information as long as we're willing to have some limits.
I think that the horse is already out of the barn. Millions of people, from young people and teenagers up through adults, use AI for mental health purposes, for health and wellness purposes, and there's no going back. So we better figure out a way to make it safe and useful. One of the things we'll hear later in this episode is that something as seemingly straightforward as MyChart can present challenges for folks. You get a test now, and sometimes, or maybe most of the time, you're seeing that test before your provider.
I actually think that the information that you get unfiltered through MyChart is a great microcosm of this whole question of how should patients approach health information and how can clinicians support them in that effort. I had a procedure recently and got a biopsy back, and I got that result before my really quick doctor had a chance to reply. I beat her by about an hour. So she was super fast, but I still got the information first. And in my case, it was entirely a good experience. I got the result. I didn't know the implications of one part of the result, so I looked it up using a reputable source. That was really helpful. I understood a little bit better. It gave me a moment to think about whether I had questions to ask of her. Didn't really, but I might have had I not had the access to that health information. And then she came in shortly thereafter and essentially gave the same context to me, which I think sensitized me to the fact of I could have just exercised a little bit of patience. And if it were bad news, I wouldn't have had to sat there and worried for very long. I could have just trusted my doctor was going to get me the info. I think the same thing is true of lots of these other things. If I'm going to access the information quickly without a filter, I have to take responsibility for what that means. I need to ask myself, am I going to really freak out and suffer if I don't have them to give me some context right away? And if so, maybe I should hold off and wait until the doctor tells me so I can have the information as part of a conversation. Or when I had a question, what trustworthy place am I going to go to look this up? I'm not just going to throw into Google, what does it mean that X? Because somebody's probably going to try to sell something to me that I don't need. And why would I want to get half-baked information? I think our patients can be empowered by better clarity about what's trustworthy.
Let's talk about reputable sources of information, the sources that you find safe and effective and reputable.
It is so important to consider where you get your health information when you're about to throw something into a browser window or a search engine or an AI. First, I think just having that awareness that not every source of information is trustworthy and that there are financial interests out there, some of which are fine and some of which are nefarious. We have to be careful and skeptical, even of the information we get from good sources. We can't expect everybody to be a cutting-edge scientist. That's not the ask. It's just about knowing where to look. I think there are some trustworthy national sources of information with a couple of exceptions. The CDC has really good information about a number of health conditions, but as I think most people are aware of, their vaccine messaging has been broken in the last year or so. Their vaccine committee has been subtracted of expertise and a bunch of anti-vaxxers have been put in chairs there. And so I no longer trust them for vaccine information. The NIH also has a webpage that you can search for information about health conditions. And generally speaking, that's trustworthy information. There are also leading hospitals around the country that run trustworthy health sites. So Mayo Clinic, Harvard Medical School are examples where you can get trustworthy information from them. There are also leading national societies that I go to for other information, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Infectious Diseases Society of America are where I go for vaccine-related information nowadays. I, as an infectious diseases physician, love the Infectious Diseases Society of America page in general for things related to infection. The American Heart Association has great information about prevention of heart disease and strokes. The American Diabetes Association has incredible information for people wanting to lower the risk from diabetes. I think that it is beyond most patients' ability to select every single possible trustworthy source of information, but I do think it's a completely legit question to ask their clinician to say, hey, I have more questions about this new diagnosis. Where can I go to get some more information so I ask you good questions next time I see you? And either the doctor will just rattle off a list right there and then, or they can send you a MyChart message and follow up. I think that would be a nice place to start.
If you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, we're going to link all of those websites in the description. Go look at those organizations and the information that they provide. I want to talk for a second about how patients can be an active participant in their healthcare team. We've talked a lot today about the questions that they should ask, the information that they need to know, the ways that they can get information. What are two or three of the most important ways that you can be an active participating member of your healthcare?
I think about this as a clinician and also as a patient myself. I think number one is ask questions. I trust my healthcare providers and I understand that asking them questions is not disrespectful and that it is my body and it is my health and I have every right to ask good questions. If I don't understand something, I'm gonna say, hey, can you help me understand this? Or where can I read some more about that? Or if what I really want to achieve with my health is this, is it that important that I take that medicine? Those questions are great. You can let the clinician's response to your questions guide next steps. If clinicians cut off your questions, if they just don't have time to listen, maybe it's not a great fit for you. Whereas if they take the time to really answer, that's probably a trustworthy person that you can go to for more questions. I'm always paying attention to the way a clinician responds. Did they respond to my goals that I set in my health? Or is it just kind of one size fits all medicine? The other thing I think is really important is you want to come with a trust but verify approach. So my clinicians are great. They get up in the morning to save lives and reduce suffering. And so I trust them. I give them respect of that. But when they do say, hey, we can wait for 5 years to do a colonoscopy again, or it's not necessary to treat that one blood pressure that was high, I also look it up after and I get a sense of it. And then I come back in dialogue with them about any questions that come over. I make sure that over time, we're having a long-term conversation. Hey, you remember 6 months ago, we talked about this thing. I had another question. Can we talk about that some more? As a patient who's empowered, I can help steer the conversation like that. I think the last thing I would bring up is that, generally speaking, the doctor, the PA, the nurse practitioner you see is paid to provide you good care. And so when they give you a recommendation, it may be totally on target. It may be just a little bit off because they're an imperfect human being, but their motivation was good. I would contrast that with whoever is out there on some internet webpage who either wants to sell you a vitamin or who wants to get you angry at somebody else and elicit an emotional reaction and then tells you that you need to do something and doesn't back it up with science. I'd be real careful of sources of information like that because unlike that hardworking, trustworthy healthcare provider, those people probably want to sell you a bill of goods.
That was Dr. Tim Leahy, Director of Medical Ethics, Infectious Diseases Specialist at UVM Medical Center, talking about health literacy, how to get involved, and how to find information you can trust to protect your own health and wellness. We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we're going to hear from two community engagement specialists about their touch points with members of the community and how they're teaching people to be active participants in their care. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking about building trust through communication, health literacy, wellness, and what to know before you go into your healthcare provider's office. We're joined now by Jerry Amori, the principal of Communicating Healthcare, a certified professional healthcare risk manager, and a patient and family advisor. And Maria Avery, community outreach manager for University of Vermont Libraries. Thank you for joining us. Both of you are experts in what people need to know when they're coming into the hospital on how doctors and healthcare need to interface with the community. When you start this conversation out in the community, what are the questions that you get most often? I'm sure you get 1.5 million questions. What are those ones that are continually coming back up?
I think mostly it's where to start with health information. What's reliable? Where do I put my trust? And I think a lot of folks are trying really hard to do quote unquote the right thing. One of my first questions to folks are, where are you getting your health information from? And I get the usual answers of the Mayo or the Cleveland Clinic. And those are great answers, but I often feel like they're telling me what they think I want to hear so they can get like a gold star at the end of the session or something. Hardly anybody will come out and say something like, oh, I rely on my cousin to share some news articles on Facebook before I go to the doctor. Not a lot of people are going to admit that.
They do it.
But they do it. We know that misinformation is spreading and doctors are hearing it more and more in appointments. So we know it's being consumed and it's being engaged with.
Let's talk about AI for a second. Maybe I'm making too big a deal of this. You tell me if I am, but it is frightening to me that you have multiple layers now. You not only have to wade through this information that may or may not be source information, but you have this filter that is now put on the results of the source information query that you've done. That is scary as heck to me because it's not even what you asked. It's what the AI thinks you asked or supposes you really wanted to ask.
Yeah, it's scary. And I think it's really overwhelming for people. They want to get a quick and easy answer for a lot of their questions. And I understand that we're all busy and we have access to so much information. So it feels like we should just be able to type a quick question in somewhere and get the perfect right answer. And that is what that summarization that the chatbots are doing. They do it really well. That speed and accessibility, that's really alluring. And I was just reading that like 1 in 3 patients are getting their health information from chatbots, which is staggering to me. It's hard because your health is so personal. It's so individual. And you really need multiple sources of information, including your doctor, to really be able to find a perfect fit for your care.
Especially older people. And I live in a community of older people. And among the things I find is that people don't understand how the healthcare system works now. And so there's a lot of frustration about my doctor only had 10 minutes to talk with me, and I was just getting started and brought him all the information I found on the internet about this, and they didn't seem to want to look at it or care about it. There needs to be knowledge, not only about how to use AI, because the other thing that happens is someone's kids find stuff on AI and say, tell your doctor you need this. And the patients don't know. The people themselves don't know. They're overwhelmed by it. So we need to be teaching people not only how to sort out what they're looking at and reading online, but also how to understand that that's a supplement for, not instead of their doctor. And that's a really hard thing to sort out. You know, I've been focusing on older folks just because I am one, but I speak with a lot of younger people. And I think it's really hard for people in their late teens and 20s as well, because they're embarking finally on taking responsibility for their own health care. They haven't had to do that. And the stuff on the internet and the influencers, it's pretty hard to ignore it. My own granddaughter was wanting me to take some sort of super hormone thing because she wanted me to be healthy and happy. And I'm like, look at this website. And she really couldn't see it. The guy has an MD. Well, that just means he went to medical school. It doesn't mean that he's telling you what's valid in this case. I think people have to be really careful. We talk about scams about our money, but we really should be talking about medical scams about our health as well.
What do we do when a friend or a loved one presents you with something that you know is misinformation? They've been sucked up into this. It's happened to everyone. Even if you don't know it's happened to you, it's happened to you. It's okay. We all have. But if you're someone that has had a conversation and you come away from it saying, man, I need to talk with them. I need to help them not be in this anymore. How do you do that?
I can tell you what I did. I was like, this is great. And what are the sources of their information? Let's go look for the articles that they're referring to. And of course, at first, she was really angry with me. I was raining on her parade, sort of. I was way too paranoid, she thought. But in the end, she had to admit that she hadn't checked out her sources. And my parting answer to her was, thank you for caring about me. Thank you for loving me and wanting me to live forever. And I will look into this further. And I wish that you would too. And then we left it at that. Handle it gracefully, understanding it comes from a place of love, but at the same time, realizing that you can't just let it lie.
Yeah, you can't fault anybody because, like you're saying, Phil, it's so easy to click a reshare or engage with something without digging into every citation or every claim. Somebody, it's so right to come at it with the care to understand that it does come out of somebody really caring about you. So many people don't even want to engage in conversations about mis or disinformation because it's become so synonymous with something political. I would love folks to interrogate that a little bit more too. Why is something like information so political? Who pushes that narrative and why are they pushing that narrative?
Just to echo Maria, I love it. It's a response that's based in empathy and in being interested, but also being discerning. And that is the secret mixture, if I've ever seen one. Jerry, you talked at the beginning about what folks need when they're getting ready to go to a healthcare appointment. How can they prepare?
You've got to be prepared. You can't forget your questions. And if you're monitoring something, you need to bring some records with you. I do spot checking of my blood pressure through the year, and I bring it with me. And I say, here's my spot checks, or here's how much weight I've lost or gained. I just keep some logs. A lot of people have illnesses like my spouse where he needs to really monitor something, and he needs to bring that with him. Because when the provider sees you, it's only one moment in time. It's like taking a photograph. And that photograph only tells you what that person looks like right then. And that doesn't really help your physician with the trajectory of your health issues. You really need to be monitoring things that need to be monitored. If you're that age, or if you're a kid and you're growing, or if you're a teen and you're being sexually active, you want to know what's been going on with your sexual health or whatever you're going to see the doctor about. Bring some notes with you and bring 3 questions with you. Now, you may actually have 10 questions, but prioritize and take the 3 main ones because you may only have 15 minutes for that particular visit. You have to be able to say what's most important. One last piece. Your provider is a human being, and I'm always telling the patients with whom I work, remember, treat like you want to be treated. Remember that we're in this together. We're partners. We're not adversaries in care.
Community outreach, again, something that's already happening and has been happening for some time. So we know it's important and we know that our healthcare organizations know it's important. Are there events or public resources that you want people to know about?
Absolutely. Yeah. Jerry and I put on a program through public libraries and various community organizations called Health Bites and Insights, Prepare for Your Care. So you leave that session both with Jerry's expertise from the healthcare system and getting equipped with what questions you need to be bringing to your appointments. And then I come in and share how you can cut through the noise of online information, health information that can be really overwhelming. And I give some demos on how to interact with these sources, both trustworthy and maybe some that aren't so much, and some things to look out for, you know, those red and green flags that you can look out for online to both find trustworthy information and keep yourself safe.
We will link to these resources as much as we are able to in the podcast description of the episode. So if you're listening to the podcast version of Living Healthy Together, check out the description. There'll be some information and resources there for you. That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thank you, Jerry Amori. Thank you, Maria Avery. Thank you, Dr. Tim Leahy, and the rest of our guests today for sharing insight, information, and helping people prepare for their healthcare. I'm your host, Philip Rao. I'll see you next time.